KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If there's things that are wasteful, show us what they are. But don't use the chainsaw to just eliminate the Department of Education.
With a new education secretary in place, how will the Trump administration carry out its plans to shut down the department?
For Thursday, March 6th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, we'll look at how the federal government is responding to the measles outbreak in Texas.
Because when it comes to an infectious disease, prevention is always better than treatment.
Also, European leaders meet to decide how much money they can spend on defense.
And traffic is picking up to the moon as two commercial companies land probes there in less than a week.
We're shedding power as fast as we can to keep the vehicle in good health. We are working to evaluate exactly what our orientation is on the surface.
Plus, South Korean superstar director Bong Joon-ho is back with the movie Mickey 17.
That's ahead. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. President Trump is again expressing doubts about NATO's mutual defense pact. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports it's something he did in his first term, too.
A week ago, Trump said he would support the key provision of NATO that requires members to come to the defense of another if attacked. But now he's told reporters at the White House that the U.S. may not defend allies if they don't spend enough on their militaries.
Well, I think it's common sense, right? If they don't pay, I'm not going to defend them. No, I'm not going to defend them. I got into a lot of heat when I said that. He said, oh, he's violating NATO.
Trump has regularly sent mixed signals about U.S. support for NATO. He long pushed allies in the alliance to increase their spending on defense, charging that the U.S. should not have to carry such a high financial burden of European security. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
The Trump administration is looking to sell hundreds of federal buildings and is firing the people who run them. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, the cutbacks are to the Federal General Services Administration, or GSA.
The Trump administration now has its cost-cutting sights on the GSA, which is basically the largest landlord in the U.S. This week, it listed hundreds of buildings that it's looking to sell: courthouses, historic buildings, and even the headquarters of the Departments of Justice, Agriculture, and the GSA itself. It then pulled some of those buildings off its list. Sources tell NPR that the agency has also abruptly fired more than 1,000 workers.
That's just mind-boggling.
Michelle Berkovich is an employment attorney who represents federal workers.
It seems to be doing an end run around Congress, who has already dictated this agency's budget.
The GSA, in a statement, says it is taking action to reduce the deficit and increase efficiency. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
An unvaccinated adult in New Mexico who tested positive for measles has died. It happened just over the border from Texas, where a measles outbreak continues to grow. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
New Mexico health officials are still investigating the individual's cause of death, but they confirmed that the person tested positive for measles. Last week, Texas health officials reported the death of an unvaccinated child. Doctors stress the best defense against measles is vaccination. Dr. Adam Ratner, an infectious disease specialist, says misinformation online suggests vitamin A can prevent measles, but that's wrong.
What is circulating online now are people who are giving vitamin A at high doses over long periods of time to try to prevent children from getting measles, and that can be quite dangerous.
He says vitamin A can build up in the body and can be toxic to the liver. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are in positive territory. That's after Wall Street sharply lower by the closing bell. You're listening to NPR News. The Republican-controlled House today voted to censure Democratic Congressman Al Green after he disrupted President Trump's speech to a joint session of Congress Tuesday, calling on Trump to cancel planned Medicaid cuts. 10 moderate Democrats voted with all the Republicans to censure Green, but today's action turned into a shouting match as some members gathered around Green to sing "We Shall Overcome," and that elicited shouting from Republicans to stop singing. Censure is a formal way for the House to express disapproval of an action by a member, but it doesn't take away rights or privileges. Global aid organizations say their supply of food that's specially designed for malnourished children is dwindling. This comes after the Trump administration dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development and froze most foreign assistance. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel has more.
The International Rescue Committee typically feeds more than 600,000 malnourished kids each year. Jeanette Bailey works for IRC. She says the Trump administration has cut off funding for many of their feeding programs.
We are receiving word from our programs in the field, in Mali, in Niger, in Nigeria, in Tanzania, in northeast Syria, that by the end of this month, we will have run out of food.
A spokesperson for the State Department said in a statement, the goal is to align programs with the national interest and make America safer, stronger, and more prosperous. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading positive. Dow futures up 0.2%. NASDAQ futures are up about 0.5%. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. We'll begin this hour with the fate of the U.S. Department of Education. NPR has obtained a draft of an executive order that President Trump is expected to sign calling for the department's closure. Democrats swiftly condemned the order, as well as Bernie Sanders, independent senator from Vermont.
Do we need to make the Department of Education more efficient? I believe we do. Do we need to destroy it and wreak havoc for working class families across this country? Absolutely not.
NPR's Corey Turner is covering this story. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Ari.
What does the order say, and do you know when it might come out?
Yeah, there had been some thought that Trump might sign it today, but the White House then came out and said he would not. We've already been expecting it for a month. I did get a draft of the order last night, though, and it instructs the newly confirmed Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, to, quote, take all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the Department of Education. But, Ari, it also conditions that, saying to the maximum extent permitted by law. And that's interesting because President Trump cannot legally close the department on his own. It was created by an act of Congress, as were most of its signature responsibilities. And so changing them in a way permitted by law would require congressional approval. And that would almost certainly require 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a Democratic filibuster.
Other parts of the federal government have experienced a sort of death by a thousand cuts. Could that be the Education Department's future?
I mean, we're already seeing that happening there. Hundreds of staff have been laid off or put on paid leave. The administration has also canceled hundreds of millions of dollars in education research grants. It's kind of ironic, Ari. This draft order complains that students have made little progress in reading or math over the years. And yet Trump's Department of Government Efficiency just cut programs focused specifically on improving reading and math instruction. Another program they cut involved mentoring and supporting teens with disabilities as they make what can be a pretty difficult transition from high school into the working world. All of it cut, again, under the umbrella of wasteful spending.
You've often explained on this program that one key responsibility of the Education Department is protecting the rights of kids with disabilities and helping schools pay for special ed. What happens to those programs and protections if the administration does away with the department?
So in her Senate confirmation hearing, Education Secretary Linda McMahon tried to assure lawmakers the goal was not to cut that funding. She said the money and civil rights enforcement could simply be moved to different, perhaps separate federal agencies. But the department was created to bring these folks together under one roof, really to make things more efficient. There's also a bigger tension here, Ari. You know, the executive order mentions that all department funding should be subject to the Trump administration's new anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion rules. The problem is a huge focus of federal disability law for children is inclusion. You know, before those laws in the 1970s, kids with disabilities were regularly excluded. They were turned away from schools, or they were warehoused, or even institutionalized. You know, I have talked to so many parents of kids with disabilities over the years as a reporter, for whom inclusion is not a bad word. For these families, it is a gold standard. And if the past is any indication, many states weren't willing to do it on their own until the U.S. government stepped in.
And NPR's Corey Turner, thank you.
You're welcome.
The measles outbreak in West Texas continues to grow. There are currently 159 reported cases, 22 patients have been hospitalized, and a school-aged child has died. So has an unvaccinated adult just over the border in New Mexico. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. addressed the outbreak in an editorial for Fox News, and that's now posted on the HHS website. Kennedy says the CDC has sent vaccines and treatments to Texas, but his emphasis on vitamin A as a treatment for measles worries infectious disease doctors. NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy is here with more. Hi there.
Hi.
Maria, tell us about this op-ed. What did Kennedy have to say?
So he acknowledged that measles is highly contagious, that it poses health risks, especially to people who are not vaccinated. He said vaccines not only protect individual children from measles, but also contribute to community immunity, which protects people who can't be vaccinated. But he didn't outright encourage people to get their children vaccinated, which is usually a key part of the public health response during an outbreak. He said the decision to vaccinate is a personal one. And he said good nutrition is the best defense against chronic and infectious diseases. And for measles, he said vitamin A can, quote, dramatically reduce deaths from the disease.
Well, tell us, can vitamin A treat measles?
Well, so there's some truth here. There's evidence from studies done in low and middle income countries that shows that giving vitamin A to malnourished children who have measles can reduce the risk of severe disease and death. There's less evidence in the U.S. Vitamin A deficiency isn't common here. And thanks to vaccines, measles deaths are rare. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend 2 doses of vitamin A for children who have the disease, especially if they're so sick they are hospitalized. But vitamin A does not prevent measles, and there's a lot of misinformation out there that suggests it does. Here's Dr. Adam Ratner. He's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Infectious Diseases Committee.
What is circulating online now are people who are giving vitamin A at high doses over long periods of time to try to prevent children from getting measles, and that can be quite dangerous.
You know, Ratner says vitamin A can build up in the body and can be toxic to the liver. And, you know, in another interview with Fox News, Kennedy said that doctors in Texas are getting good results from cod liver oil.
Really? Cod liver oil?
Well, that's what Kennedy said. We have not confirmed cod liver oil is being used in the Texas outbreak. It is high in vitamin A, but doctors tell me there's no evidence that cod liver oil can help treat measles. And because it's so high in vitamin A, you could end up giving your child potentially toxic amounts. I spoke with Dr. Amish Adalja with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He wanted Kennedy to emphasize vaccines to prevent measles rather than supplements to treat it.
I think mentions of cod liver oil and vitamin A is just distracting people away from what the single message should be, which is increase the vaccination rate, and then you don't even have to think about treatment. Because when it comes to an infectious disease, prevention is always better than treatment.
Other doctors I spoke with agree that the main message, especially during an outbreak, should be get vaccinated.
NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy, thank you.
My pleasure.
It was a tense day today on the moon. A private company called Intuitive Machines was attempting to land a probe near the South Pole. Part of its mission was to hunt for water, but things did not go according to plan. NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfiel has been following the landing attempt. Hey, Jeff.
Hi there.
So did this company's probe actually make it to the surface of the moon?
Yeah, kind of. The landing went according to plan as it dropped down towards this flat mountaintop near the South Pole where it was supposed to land. But then right at the moment of touchdown, things seemed to go kind of wrong. Mission control went silent. There were a lot of looking around for signals and things. And at a press conference this afternoon, Intuitive Machines CEO Steve Altemus said the lander was on the ground, but in the wrong orientation.
We've been very successful to this point. However, I do have to tell you that we don't believe we're in the correct attitude on the surface of the moon yet again.
And by yet again, he means the lander may have tipped over on its side, and that's what happened the last time Intuitive Machines tried to land on the moon last year.
But they've got company, because just a few days ago, a different commercial probe landed on the moon, right?
That's right. On Sunday, a lander built by a company called Firefly Aerospace absolutely nailed it.
Al Khan, chief engineer on ops. Y'all set for landing. We're on the moon.
So that's what it's supposed to sound like when you land on the moon. But you know what? Landing on the moon is really hard. These probes can't use parachutes because there's no air on the moon. And they're too far from Earth to be flown by remote control. They've got to use rocket thrusters to hover and land themselves. And that's just really tricky to do autonomously.
So what was the lander that touched down today supposed to do?
You know, the South Pole is a super interesting place on the moon. Scientists believe there's water there hidden in permanent shadow and craters. Water is essential for future astronauts, for life support, and as rocket fuel to get them back off the moon. It's going to be an incredibly valuable resource. This probe was supposed to land about 100 miles from the South Pole. It had a drill on it that would drill in the ground looking for water. It had a bunch of little rovers that were going to jump around and drive around. It was going to be pretty cool. We'll have to see whether any of that science can be salvaged now.
Why are all these companies trying to land on the moon right now?
Well, you know, NASA has plans to put astronauts back on the moon. And as part of that, they've hired a bunch of companies to send these small probes there first. It's thought that they might eventually be delivering supplies to astronauts on the surface. The program so far has had mixed results, I think it's safe to say. Firefly nailed its landing, but Intuitive Machine and another company, Astrobotic, have all struggled to reach the moon successfully. And I should add, actually, there's a little bit of a question mark right now hanging over the whole lunar landing program to send astronauts back to the moon. Trump's close ally, Elon Musk, owns SpaceX. He has founded that company with the goal of going to Mars, not the moon. And earlier this year, he called the moon, quote, a distraction. And Trump himself talked about landing on Mars in his inaugural address earlier this year, but he didn't mention anything about the moon.
I've often been distracted by the moon. NPR's Jeff Brumfiel, thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. The 2025 Subaru Outback features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, including safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Say you're a director, and your last movie won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and picked up a Golden Globe, and then, icing on the cake, went on to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. How the heck do you follow that up? If you were Bong Joon-ho, the answer would be, wait 6 years, and then follow Parasite, the South Korean juggernaut, with a dark comedy set in space. Bong Joon-ho is back. His new movie is Mickey 17, starring Robert Pattinson as Mickey, a guy who fails in the macaroon business, heads to space to escape his loan shark, and becomes an expendable.
How many times is this? You're Mickey 16?
17. Jerk. 18 after this one.
Well, it's nice knowing you. Have a nice death. See you tomorrow.
Bong Joon-ho and his interpreter, Sharon Choi, are in our New York bureaus. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Explain the whole concept of an expendable and how by the time we meet him, we are on version 17 of Mickey.
그 17이라는 넘버 자체가
So the number 17 indicates that Mickey has died 17 times, and we spend most of our time with the 17 iteration of Mickey, and he dies because it's his job to be an expendable, to go through these repeated deaths. He's sent out to do all these dangerous missions, usually fatal missions, and he can go through these multiple deaths because he is reprinted after each death.
로봇 패틴슨이 계속 출력되는요.
Yeah, so to put it simply, it's a movie where Robert Pattinson gets printed again and again.
Yes, his body gets, I mean, I'll call it, it's 3D printed out, basically. His memory gets re-uploaded. Then we're on to the next version. What struck me is this is so weird and sad because he does keep being forced to die, and yet you also make it really funny. We're laughing as we're talking about this.
Yeah, it's very sad and funny, especially because the character that Robert Pattinson plays, he's kind of this, you know, guy who's too nice for his own good, gets into so many sort of unfortunate situations, but really tries hard to live out his life. And through some mistakes that happen in the film, he ends up coming across the 18th iteration of himself. So Robert plays two different roles in this film, you can say. But unfortunately, 18 is a crazy nut job.
Totally different.
Yes, he is. So just setting aside the ethical questions for a moment, a practical question. How do you direct that? Because as you said, you have Robert Pattinson, one actor, playing two characters on screen at the same time for much of this movie.
So finally today, I get to reveal a very big secret that we've all been trying to keep hidden. Actually, Robert Pattinson is a twin, and his twin brother has been in hiding, and I was very lucky to be able to cast his twin brother for his screen debut.
So there is no VFX for the two Pattinson in one frame. It's all very realistic approach. Thank you.
Wait, I'm trying to figure out if you're actually kidding me. You're kidding me, right? Yes. Okay.
근데 뭐 정말 VFX 팀이 열심히.
Yeah, so that was definitely a joke, and the VFX department worked very hard. But Rob also worked really hard to make sure the differences, the delicate differences between 17 and 18, really land on the screen. And especially because Mickey 18 goes through a transformation in the film, we also see many different sides of Mickey 18. So with Rob's amazing work and effort, we really get to see these very different characters.
Mm. I kept, as I was watching all of the Mickeys dying and then coming back and doing another job and another mission and then dying and being reprinted, I kept thinking about the pandemic and about COVID and about real life essential workers who were being asked to show up on site to do their jobs, often at great personal risk and for the benefit of the rest of us. Was any of that on your mind as you thought about Expendables?
그 말씀하신 것처럼 이제 영화 속에서 미키가
Yeah, so as you said, Mickey goes through all these deaths in the film, and everyone is just like, well, you signed the contract. It's your job to die. We don't have to feel guilty about the fact that you are constantly going through these grueling deaths. And I think that really shows the cowardice of the society, the community, and the system around him, where they all sort of make him do all these dangerous things, and they're able to relieve themselves from the guilt by saying, oh, that's just his job. There's a way they can justify it. But then you see sort of the creepers, the unique creatures in this film who operate through a totally opposite mechanism. And I think the contrast we see from the humans and the creepers is very important to this film.
Just to help people visualize the creepers, they look to me like a kind of cross between a giant roly-poly and a Snuffleupagus from Sesame Street. But they're really smart. Is that accurate?
Sesame Street. 그 되게 여러 가지로 해석되는 것 같아요.
누구도 Yeah, I think people have been interpreting their look in many different ways. Some have pointed out the resemblance to roly-polies. But the creature designer and I, early on in the stage, we talked a lot about armadillos. And the sort of the starting point, the genesis of the creeper's look is actually croissants.
I want to ask about Mickey 17 and how it lines up or doesn't to your past work. I mean, I mentioned Parasite in the intro because it was such a huge success both for critics and in the box office. Mickey 17 seems very different. It's in English, all in English, not Korean for starters. But do you find your films in conversation with each other? Are there callbacks here to your past work, things you're still playing with?
굳이 따지자면
You know, at the bottom of all these films, I think, is a story about the human condition, you know, exploring questions of what does it mean to live a truly human life and how can we live a truly human life? I think that's the central question at the story of the young son in Parasite and also at the heart of a Mickey's story. You know, he has this very extreme job, but he somehow tries to find a way to get treated like a proper human being, to live a truly human life. So in that sense, I think Mickey 17 is also an extension of the questions that Parasite explores.
I love that. Well, not to spoil the ending of Mickey 17, but it is kind of a happy ending, which I was not expecting. What takeaway do you hope people will walk away with?
저번에 제가 이렇게 해피엔딩 안 했었나 봐요. 놀라는 분들이 있긴 있더라고요. 그리고
Yeah, a lot of people were quite surprised at the ending. I guess my endings have always been a bit unhappy. But making Mickey 17, I sort of looked back on the characters that I dealt with before and kind of felt that I was quite perhaps overly harsh to them. And regardless of whether this ending is happy or sad, I just really wanted to prevent this character of Mickey Barnes from being destroyed. You know, he lives a very difficult life. Nothing is easy for him, but I just wanted to stop the world, this harsh world, from destroying this young man.
Director Bong Joon-ho and his interpreter Sharon Choi talking about the new movie, Mickey 17. This was fun. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Queen of the Ring is a new biopic about Mildred Burke, one of the first ever professional female wrestlers. Burke wrestled over 200 men in her career, was a three-time world champion, and a single mom.
Mildred Burke was a dreamer, a trailblazer, who defied the era that she was in.
Her journey to the ring tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump keeps referring to Canada's prime minister as governor, which makes Canadians furious.
The dream of the 51st state is fantasy land. It will never happen.
The two countries are closely linked, though. We'll look at how after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump has announced a pause on new 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and some from Canada for a month, as fallout from a broader trade war has alarmed both consumers and businesses. NPR's Windsor Johnson says the temporary delay reflects the regional trade deal Trump negotiated during his first term in office.
The exemption is effective immediately and will last until April 2nd. Trump's decision follows discussions with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, during which she detailed her country's efforts to cut back on illegal immigration and drug trafficking. The exemption applies to a number of Mexican goods, ranging from dairy products to clothing and fabric. The temporary reprieve is aimed at mitigating economic disruptions and stabilizing financial markets, which have taken a hit this week.
That's NPR's Windsor Johnston. Stocks finished sharply lower across the board on Wall Street today. New court filings show the Trump administration is considering an attempt to alter the 2030 census. NPR's Hansi Luong tells us Trump has already cleared a path to break with constitutional requirements involving census numbers.
The 14th Amendment says those census numbers must include the, quote, whole number of persons in each state. But the Republican state attorneys general of Louisiana, Kansas, Ohio, and West Virginia filed a lawsuit in January to try to ban the Census Bureau from including in that headcount U.S. residents without legal status and those with visas. Those states argue those residents should also be subtracted from population numbers and help determine each state's share of federal funding. A judge has now paused this lawsuit at the Trump administration's request. In court filings, Trump officials who just joined the Bureau's parent agency say they need time to determine their approach to this case in light of one of President Trump's executive orders. It revoked one from the Biden administration that affirmed census requirements set by the Constitution.
This is NPR. The UN says a funding crunch might lead to cutbacks on food assistance to refugees living in the world's largest settlement in Bangladesh. NPR's Omkar Khandekar reports the UN World Food Program helps feed more than 1 million people in Bangladesh.
The UN agency said it would have to cut its monthly food vouchers in half to $6 per person if its $81 million shortfall isn't met by the end of the month. A spokesperson for the World Food Program did not say if this is connected to President Trump's decision to cut back on foreign aid, but told NPR that the US continues to be one of their donors. The Rohingya are a persecuted Muslim minority who fled violent purges in the neighboring Myanmar, mostly in 2016 and 17. The UN agency has warned that food cuts might lead to heightened tensions in the refugee camps. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
NASA says a second lunar lander may have fallen over while touching down near the moon's south pole today. Flight controllers in Texas have yet to locate the privately owned Athena lander, which is carrying a drone, a drill, and two NASA rovers. The last time Intuitive Machines landed a spacecraft on the moon a year ago, it landed sideways. NASA is planning a flyover in the next several days to confirm Athena's position. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. European Union leaders from 27 member countries met in an emergency session in Brussels today. They unanimously agreed to move forward on plans to dramatically scale up their defense investments. The final document declares that, quote, Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine is an existential challenge for the European Union. Terry Schultz has been covering the summit in Brussels. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
3 years into the war, is this meeting happening now entirely because of Trump distancing the U.S. from Ukraine, or what's the reason?
Well, there already was huge concern here about the situation in Ukraine, but I'd say it has been greatly exacerbated in recent days by the Trump administration's suspension of U.S. assistance to Kyiv and the general expectation the U.S. will stop providing some of the important military assistance that's been Europe's own security backup in NATO. So the EU is already the largest supplier of aid to Ukraine, though you'll often hear President Trump say it's the U.S. And now it's become clear that member countries will need to spend more if the U.S. stops helping Ukraine and if it also needs to worry more about its own territorial defense.
Okay, tell us more about what the EU heads of state and government agree to in this joint statement.
Well, Ari, it's primarily a to-do list of how the top EU officials would like to see policies develop with regard to raising more money for defense spending. It doesn't at this point actually commit them to do any of these things. So the 27 leaders have agreed on the general principle that they will, quote, accelerate the mobilization of the necessary instruments and financing in order to bolster the security of the EU and the protection of their citizens. Now, that's a mouthful. So put more simply, here's how Commission President Ursula von der Leyen describes it.
So it is to the benefit of rearming Europe, rearming the European Union, but also arming Ukraine in its existential fight for its sovereignty and territorial integrity.
So the document welcomes new proposals to, for example, allow countries to circumvent EU penalties on going into too much debt, as long as that extra spending is on defense. The idea is if all EU governments increase their defense spending by 1.5% for the next 4 years, it would add 650 billion euros, that's $700 billion, to the overall EU defense budget.
How'd these votes shake out?
Well, there was a second statement, and that one was not adopted unanimously. It was about Ukraine only, and it was adopted by 26 of the 27 heads of state and government because Hungary does not support Ukraine and doesn't want the other EU members to do it either. So Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban often holds up statements or funding to assist Kyiv. So these conclusions are basically repeating EU positions, such as no negotiations on Ukraine without Ukraine, no negotiations that affect European security without Europe's involvement, any peace agreement must have robust security guarantees for Ukraine, and that any peace must respect Ukraine's independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. Now, those seem basic, Ari, but under current circumstances, for these leaders and surely for Ukrainian President Zelensky, it must feel reassuring to keep restating them.
Terry Schultz in Brussels, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It is safe to say the relationship between the U.S. and Canada is at a low point. In a pointed speech earlier this week, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau addressed the 25% import taxes that were imposed by the Trump administration.
Now, it's not in my habit to agree with the Wall Street Journal. But Donald, they point out that even though you're a very smart guy, this is a very dumb thing to do.
As of today, those tariffs have been paused until at least April 2nd. Still, what Trudeau and Canadians are particularly infuriated by is President Trump's suggestion that Canada become a 51st state. Our colleagues from The Indicator, Waylon Wong and Robert Smith, take a look at how our two countries are already linked and what we could perhaps learn from our neighbors to the north.
We called up a Canadian economist, Armin Yelnizian, and from the get-go, she had a message for Donald Trump.
The dream of the 51st state is fantasy land. It will never happen.
Okay. After she gave me a million cultural reasons why Canada does not want to join the U.S., we moved on to the economic reasons.
And the big one is that a combined U.S. and Canada would not be richer.
Oh, we'd be exactly the same. We are about as integrated as you could get.
It really started when we fought together against the Nazis in World War II. We both built these factories to make guns and tanks. And when the war was over, these factories turned to consumer goods, things like cars. U.S. factories started to get parts from Canadian factories and vice versa.
But what really unites Canada and the U.S. economically is that we face the same existential challenge. Just like the U.S., Canada had a baby boom.
And just like the U.S., those boomers are now retiring. And that changes an economy, challenges it. Both countries need more workers.
More people are aging out of the labor market than coming into it. If you don't like immigrants, expect an economic slowdown. If you don't like trade, expect an economic slowdown.
Armin suggests that the U.S. could learn from Canada in three big economic areas.
The first is immigration. For a long time, Canada has had one of the most innovative immigration systems in the world. They offered visas based on the points system, where potential immigrants were ranked based on education, work experience, and language skills.
It has been one of the great sources of our economic resilience in Canada.
She says has been because they're struggling with the immigration rules right now in Canada. They let in a lot of people temporarily after the pandemic started when they needed more workers. Then there was a backlash and they tightened the border.
We really are the same in some ways.
But the fact remains that in Canada, about a quarter of its population is foreign born. It's only about 13% in the U.S.
The second thing Armin says that the U.S. can learn from Canada is its healthcare system.
I knew this was coming. Universal healthcare.
Absolutely. The government of Canada runs healthcare. And yes, people complain about it all the time. But overall, Canadians pay less and live longer than in the U.S.
So smarter immigration, universal healthcare. And the third thing Armin offers the U.S. as a suggestion, a little something for the matriarchy.
The last 20 years, Canadian women have been more in the workforce than the United States, which reverses history since the 1960s. The way we did it is by providing women not only access to great post-secondary education where they could develop their human capital, but they could deploy it because they had access to cheap and high-quality childcare.
Cheap, high-quality childcare. Who would have thought?
I don't even know what that is. Never heard of it.
I mean, cheap relative to the United States. Armin says the United States can just steal this idea from Canada.
Yeah, you could learn from us without absorbing us. You could absorb the lesson without absorbing the country.
That's the Canadian spirit. I love it. Robert Smith.
Weilin Wong, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he wants to remove bureaucratic roadblocks by replacing the military's top legal officers. That move could affect hard-fought reforms to military justice that began after missteps in the early days of the War on Terror. Steve Walsh with WHRO in Norfolk has the story.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was recently asked to clarify what he was looking for after he moved to replace the top judge advocate generals for the Navy, Army, and Air Force.
I want the best possible lawyers in each service to provide the best possible recommendations, no matter what lawful orders that are given. And we didn't think those particular positions were well suited. And so we're looking for the best. We're opening it up to everybody to be able to be the top lawyer of those services.
Opening the process to everyone would be difficult. After 20 years of war, Congress and the services put rules in place to stop commanders and administrations from pushing aside the JAG Corps when tough decisions are being made. Mark Nevid is a former Navy JAG based in Norfolk. He's now a professor at Emory University School of Law in Atlanta.
Sometimes a lawyer has to provide guidance, has to be actually a roadblock if someone desires to do something illegal. And so I think that Hegseth has a very different view of the JAGs that does not understand the need for independent, objective legal advice.
During the early years of the Bush administration, JAGs were either not in the room or overruled when the White House was authorizing enhanced interrogation methods like waterboarding after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, Nevid says.
After the enhanced interrogation techniques, Congress passed a law basically authorizing JAGs to wear 3 stars prior to their 2-star rank. So Congress at some point recognized that you needed to have military JAGs in the room for these important discussions.
The restriction was loosened in 2016, but ultimately the Senate will have to hold hearings and vote on the final selections. Hegseth says he's looking for the best people. Over the years, he has expressed contempt for JAG officers. Here he is at his confirmation hearing, where he was asked to define what he means when he uses the slur JAGOF to describe some of them.
It would be a JAG officer who puts his or her own priorities in front of the warfighters, their promotions, their medals, in front of having the backs of those who are making the tough calls on the front lines.
Hegseth served with the Minnesota Army National Guard in Iraq and as a trainer in Afghanistan. He has long expressed his frustration with a strict interpretation of the rules of engagement. Basically, the rules set down by commanders which say what a unit can or cannot do in the field. Rachel Van Landingham is a former Air Force JAG and a law professor at Southwestern Law School, LA.
Judge advocates provide a legal review on that because the rules of engagement are rules that are bounded by the law. Commanders do whatever they want. And even if commanders wanted to exceed those left and right limits, lawyers provide advice. They don't order warfighters to do anything.
She has worked with the top Air Force JAG, Lieutenant General Charles Plummer, and found him to be a loyal and accomplished lawyer. Even when they clashed over the best way to change the system to handle cases of sexual assault, those cases led Congress to give more independence to JAGs while limiting the role of commanders in certain criminal cases.
And I wish Mr. Hegseth had really taken some time to do this in a smarter way that doesn't just send the signal that it's his way or the highway and JAGs, you just better get out of the way.
Van Landingham is now concerned that some of that independence is now in jeopardy. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Over the years, President Trump has accused the Biden administration, social media companies, and journalists of censoring conservative ideas. During his address to Congress on Tuesday, he said he's ended that.
And I have stopped all government censorship and brought back free speech in America. It's back.
But under this Trump administration, some speech can cost you. For example, the government is scrubbing the words diversity, equity, and inclusion from websites after Trump declared DEI programs, quote, immoral and illegal. Trump is also retaliating against news organizations like the Associated Press that have made coverage decisions that he doesn't like. And he is threatening to pull federal funding from colleges that allow what he calls illegal protests. To talk about all of this, we're joined now by NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, when you look at all of these things that I just mentioned, do you see a consistent theme here?
Sure. I think that on the right, there's been a belief in cancel culture, the idea that people could be targeted, taken down for things that were found to be offensive, particularly by folks on the left. There's clearly a new administration effort to uncork what has been, in some quarters, been viewed as offensive speech and to kind of embrace and celebrate it. But in reality, I think what we're seeing is the desire to control the flow of information to the public from kind of a pro-MAGA, pro-Trump point of view, rather than to say that, hey, we welcome the fractious free flow of opinion and information from all sides.
David, how does what we're seeing from the early days of the Trump administration differ from previous administrations when it comes to their policies on speech?
It's been an article of faith on the right, particularly among the MAGA right, that social media platforms have been really suppressing conservative speech. And one of the elements they point to is what happened during the pandemic. And during that time, you saw Biden administration officials really lobbying these social media platforms to tamp down on unfounded claims. And they did. Some of those claims turned out to be not utterly unfounded. The lab leak theory, for example, we just don't know at this time. Back then it was dismissed. So that was taken as a real way in which Biden had performed some sort of censorship. What Trump is doing is much less subtle than what happened in the Biden terms. You're seeing Trump really tamp down on people's ability to speak freely, pretty bluntly. One is the question of nonpartisan government officials speaking about their expertise, about the kind of research and data they've collected, and then the deep cutting back on what kinds of research they can conduct and talk about to the public. And then you're seeing private institutions being essentially pressured through the force of the government pocketbook against charting their own course on values, on areas that they want to pursue, for fear that they may cross the government and lose the funding.
So if freedom of speech is in the First Amendment, then how is this administration legally able to pursue these activities?
Look, every new administration is entitled to set its own priorities. It's why we have elections. That say the coercion of speech and the kind of demands for fealty through rhetoric, it's not always clear that it's legal. And one example, the Associated Press is suing Trump. He had them tossed out of these press pools that have been used for a century to kind of share coverage of the president and other major officials in sort of constricted circumstances, because they weren't willing to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, his preferred term. The White House says, look, it's not a right, it's a privilege, but a Trump-appointed judge was somewhat sympathetic to what the AP had to say there. Even so, many folks aren't waiting around to find out. For example, PBS scrubbed DEI from its site, as have some major universities, in fear of the federal government coming down hard on them. And, you know, there is this tension between Trump's desire for kind of a control of the message from the White House, from the Oval Office, colliding with the, at least the spirit and perhaps even the law as embodied in the Bill of Rights.
So, David, then what do you think has been the impact on our society so far when you see these types of restrictions on speech?
They're broad-ranging, and sometimes they may seem tough to pull together, but I think they're related. You've seen preemptive steps from the billionaire owners of the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post to essentially pull back on criticism of Trump, to kill, in each case, editorials endorsing Kamala Harris last fall, but also to reshape their opinion pages. You've seen a constriction of certain kinds of valued information from government sources. And even if you dislike the mainstream media, we all need credible information. A weatherman I used to know in Baltimore posted online recently pointing out, you know, all the fancy information that we get in our weather apps originally comes from NOAA, the, you know, an atmospheric agency that does that research for us. Where is it going to come from if they can't gather the information and talk about it to the public? In that case, we're all kind of driving blind, or at least perhaps being driven in a self-driving Tesla.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Since the year 2000, the number of butterflies in the U.S. has dropped by nearly a quarter, according to a new study in the journal Science. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, this decline of these fluttering bugs signals broader trouble for all kinds of insects.
People love butterflies, says ecologist Colin Edwards.
They are pretty visually distinct, and you can identify them just by walking past them.
That passion and ease of identification has sparked volunteers to spend hundreds of thousands of hours counting them.
Frankly, the amount of volunteer effort in the U.S. in looking at butterflies gives us really one of the best insect data sets in the world.
But no one had tried to combine all these patchwork efforts into a single analysis. So Edwards, currently at the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and his colleagues sorted through millions of butterfly sightings from enthusiasts and professionals to analyze how numbers have changed since the year 2000.
We saw a decrease of about 22%. If you were seeing 100 butterflies, you know, in the summer in 2000, on average across the country, you'd be seeing 78 butterflies in the year 2020.
That year-over-year decline worries David Wagner, a biologist at the University of Connecticut.
It doesn't sound like much, but 1 or 2% decline per year of any group is absolutely phenomenal when you compound that over more than one decade.
Some butterfly species actually improved in numbers, especially those that thrive closer to humans. But such success stories were rare.
We had 13 times as many species declining as we had increasing. And that was, frankly, a really rough number to see.
And it was butterflies of all kinds in every corner of the country. That generality suggests three major culprits: habitat loss, pesticide use, and climate change. And those forces are likely impacting harder-to-study insects, too. That really worries Wagner.
Insects are the little things that run the world. They're pollinating, helping with our food. And so if butterflies are declining at 1.3% a year, we can bet that these 10 million other species that share our planet and make it run, make it function, are in trouble too.
Wagner says addressing climate change and limiting pesticide use is key. And individuals can make a difference too, with simple actions like planting butterfly-friendly plants in the backyard. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
They'll be coming, they'll be going, they'll be waiting for that blowing.